There has been somewhat of a revolution on our cultural landscape in recent years. This has to be symbolised by the fact that in 2017, the Oxford English Dictionary added the word woke to its pages. Here's that definition of woke, courtesy of the OED. It's an adjective, US informal, and it means alert to injustice in society, especially racism.
In this country, in 15 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
I don't call it ratting, I call it an insurrection.
The whites have become black.
If you open your door to uncontrolled immigration from Middle Eastern countries, you are inviting in.
The British people have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must be respected.
This is not a racial problem. All we say is that we've got enough immigrants into the country, and that no more should be allowed in.
Welcome to About Race with Rennie Edo Lodge. I've noticed a cycle to the culture of woke. It pushes the limits and widens the possibilities of our culture by starting out as widespread criticism, which is then followed up by earnest action. Some examples. There was hashtag OscarsSoWhite, led by April Rain in 2016, which shook up the film industry. Then, in early 2018, we were all struck by the cult of Black Panther, which quickly became one of the highest earning films of all time. I have no idea if these two facts are related. In Britain, analysis from trade magazine The Bookseller found that in 2016, fewer than 100 of the thousands upon thousands of books published in the UK that year were written by non-white British authors. In the 2 years since, several UK publishing companies have established initiatives to redress the balance, including Penguin Random House, Faber & Faber, and Hachette. In journalism, the first woman editor of the National Geographic magazine made an unprecedented move this year when she appointed a historian to critically examine the magazine's coverage of people of colour since its inception. "For decades, our coverage was racist," read the headline. An apology was made. Back in Britain, Edward Aninfo was appointed the first black editor of British Vogue, news of which was received with much celebration. Outgoing editor Alexandra Shulman gave an interview to The Guardian, which showed her to be painfully ignorant of the issues at hand. In the art world, Lubaina Hamid won the 2017 Turner Prize for her work on slavery, colonialism, and the legacy of racism. And the Tate Modern's exhibition of art in the age of Black Power was wildly popular. Going back to that Oxford English Dictionary definition, this was all very woke. But where was this all coming from?
I think that popular culture and culture in general is becoming more attuned to those conversations. And I think that is because they become hard to ignore, particularly on social media and the conversation spaces that have been democratized because of social media and the internet.
We're militant, you're on a milli vanilli vibe. Stopping refugees is just silly blood. What you know about Aeneas in the Iliad? Fled Turkey and he just founded Rome. What if you're drowned in a boat? Yanks eat turkey because your peeps have found a home. What you think all the sounds in your phone?
The actor, rapper and activist Riz Ahmed has enjoyed a career just about long enough to witness this change in culture. Known initially for his role in the underground music scene, an independent film in the mid-2000s, he is now well established in Hollywood. Most notably, he played Bodhi Rook in Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. We met to discuss how the culture of woke has affected, well, culture at large.
I think that there's a wave, and who knows if it's a wave that will kind of like peter out, that is hard for people to ignore. And I think people are either having to ride that wave and deal with it, or they're getting kind of swept away by its force. And I think some of that is to do with, you know, democratizing the conversation in popular culture through social media. And I think some of it is also quite a direct reaction to some of the kind of nativist, xenophobic political realities we're facing in a lot of Western democracies post-austerity.
You sound pretty confident that those sort of like conversations on social media having a direct impact on what's being commissioned, what's making it to our screens.
I think some of the kind of complacency of the kind of centre-left liberals that often dominate the creative industries, both as creatives and on the business side, has been shown to be misplaced. That complacency has been challenged by some of the electoral results we've seen, you know, with Brexit or with Trump or lots of what's been happening in mainland Europe, you know, the political reality in India right now. And I think that complacent bubble, that kind of delusion that we were slowly heading towards, you know, this land of milk and honey, I think that delusion, that bubble's been burst, really. And because of that, I think people are realizing that we won't inevitably drift towards an inclusive and tolerant society necessarily. I think there's this realization now that we have to kind of show up and push things uphill at times to get there.
There's loads of us in Britain who see Riz as a British success story. He's won an Emmy and was also named as one of Time magazine's 100 influential people by Hamilton powerhouse Lin-Manuel Miranda. I wanted to know whether he thinks this is a chicken or egg situation.
So I'm able to have more of a career because things are changing in the industry. And as I have more of a career, that means that things can change more in the industry. This isn't just, I mean, you brought up me as an example. I don't think my personal success necessarily has any kind of change on the structures or the systemic challenges that we face. But if there are lots of people like me or like you that start doing well in our industry, then it does start changing things. And it's hard to know what comes first or what needs to come first, whether it's kind of a benevolent person who's steeped in privilege, who decides to kind of take a risk and back some horses. You know, J.J. Abrams and Kathy Kennedy saying, hang on a minute, let's cast John Boyega and Daisy Ridley, a woman and a British Nigerian guy. Whether it's that and the people in privilege kind of need to kind of, you know, bequeath us, you know, a seat at the table, or whether it's like, you know, certain people just become too good to ignore. And actually, I think it's often a combination of both.
All of this seems ostensibly good, but have we been here before? Meera Syal is a stalwart of the British entertainment industry, with a decades-long career that has comprised of comedy, acting, writing books and plays, and presenting television. The list is almost endless, and her numerous awards reflect this. I asked her if, in this moment of woke, she was currently experiencing a severe case of déjà vu.
Now the first time I talked about this was way back at the Edinburgh Television Festival, probably in the mid-80s. And there are probably sections of that speech I could get out and read again now. So there is an ebb and a flow, and we have to. That's why you have to be so vigilant. And that's why the monitoring of what is happening on our television and film industries, of course, which Lenny Henry really spearheaded, because that monitoring stopped for a while. And that's where he came in and said, you know, we've stopped monitoring what's going on and it's got bad. And here are the new figures. We need to start this again. It's two steps forward, one step back. It's really easy to get complacent. Trying to get the stories that don't tell the narrative that the commissioners want to hear, trying to get them on is really difficult. And that's the next step. What does give me a lot of hope is I think a lot of artists, like you've just said, are understanding that going to the old institutions, there is too much to dismantle and too many people to persuade of a different way of seeing the world. You can do it yourself. There is a democratization of storytelling going on through the internet, through social media and social platforms, which is changing the way that work is made. And I find that quite exciting. You know, if you build it, they will come.
Absolutely.
They are there. Mm. It's just that you're not serving them. And the less you serve them, the more they're going to go to the niche platforms like their ZTVs or their Netflix Indies, and they're going to abandon you.
We tried hard to speak to a television or film commissioner for this episode. These are the people who determine what we're watching. Gatekeepers in the strictest sense. Unfortunately, none really wanted to speak to me. But an interesting turn of events meant that I could discuss the issues with a very successful film producer instead. Alison Owen has been in the business for almost 30 years. We met in a cafe in West London, so do excuse the background noise.
I would say my best known films are Elizabeth, which is about Queen Elizabeth, that was nominated for an Oscar quite a way back now, yeah, 98. Suffragette, Saving Mr. Banks, Emma Thompson and Tom Hanks. I told you my memory was bad. Me Before You, which came out last year. I'm just gearing up to do a film version of Kathleen Moran's How to Build a Girl.
So what does film production involve?
It can involve lots of different things. I tend to be pretty much an A to Z producer, which means that I will generate the films, I will have an idea myself, or read a book that I want to make into a film, or read an article, or meet a writer who's got a great idea that I want to develop with them. So I will start by optioning that material, raising money or spending my own money on that option and to develop a script. And then when I've got a script, I will put it together with the director, get some cast, go raise the money, make the film, sell it if it's not already sold along the way, and make sure it gets the right release out into the world.
Get some cast. What does that mean? How involved are you in the casting of films?
Very involved. I mean, I have to be very involved. I am the conduit between the director and the creative side and the financiers, which is the financial side. So I straddle both sides. So I obviously want what's best creatively for the movie. I also have to be aware of what's going to work in the marketplace and what's going to raise the money. So I will be the person who is maybe encouraging the director to think more commercially about their creative ideas. And I will be the person encouraging the financier to maybe be a bit more open-minded and think imaginatively and try and get the two people to meet in the middle.
This interview has come about because your daughter, Lily Allen, randomly tweeted both me and the author Nikesh Shukla,
right,
who is the editor of an anthology named The Good Immigrant that I contribute to.
Right.
And Nikesh was tweeting and he was saying, look at the success of the Black Panther film. Look at the success of Rennie's book. It's just become a bestseller. Anybody who says that diversity doesn't sell, I just want to have a word. And I think that was a thinly veiled threat on Nikesh's part. Lily tweeted us both and she said, my mum is a film producer. I asked her if she felt stupid for having ignored this market. She said she has tried countless times to get films with diverse, in quotes, casts, / subject matters off the ground. But bigwigs can't relate to, / see themselves in the stories, so they never sign off.
Sounds like something I would say. Ooh. And that certainly does represent the many conversations and attempts I've had over the years.
Mm.
And as I would say, it mirrors my efforts to get women on screen. It's the same thing. I'm pretty much obsessed with the female gaze and trying to get that represented on screen properly. And that has also obviously has an intersectional aspect to it in terms of wanting to represent ethnic diversity on screen. I would say it's certainly become slightly easier. And I hope that Black Panther will have smashed a lot of people's preconceived notions and it will be even easier in future. But certainly the first time when I made a film called Young Americans in 1990, that was my first experience of really getting slapped around the face with it, when we cast a mixed race girl with a white boy and we had our finance pulled from the movie because of
that. Wow.
And they said if we cast Tandy Newton, she was straight out of drama school. They said if we cast Tandy, they would pull the money out.
Wow.
And of course, we said, fuck you, we're going to cast Tandy. And they did pull the money out and we had to refinance the movie.
Wow.
And that was a real eye-opener. And at that point, interestingly, because things ebb and flow over the years and the decades, at that point, it was an American problem. It was American money that we lost. The British money was fine and did not have a problem with it. It was the American money that got pulled out and we had to refinance the movie pretty much out of Europe and Britain. I would say that probably America has got better and Britain has stayed sort of the same. I would say that America's accelerated in its relationship with it. Often I think it's easier to get things on TV over here. I did a project a while ago called Small Island.
Oh yeah, based on Andrea Levy's book.
Exactly, in which the BBC were very supportive and we had a lot of success with that and it got Emmys and whatever. So that kind of project is easier to make on British television than on American television, and that's probably still the case for network television at any rate. differences between the two cultures, but problems all along the way, yeah.
As a producer, Alison casts. As an actor, Riz is casted. I was interested in his perspective on this issue.
You said at the beginning of our interview that you work a lot in the US. That tells me that the roles in the UK are still lacking for you.
I think the roles are lacking here, but I also think, and this isn't me letting the UK off the hook, I think it is just so much more of a kind of old boys network here. It is just so upper middle class and white and posh over here. I think there are real problems here in terms of who the gatekeepers are and just, you know, I think it really, the issue in the UK is like our idea of who we are as a nation, what counts as a story worthy of being told to the nation. What is our national story? We're in denial about it. Basically, America's in denial about its national story in other ways. But our idea of ourselves is lords and ladies running around in bonnets. America's idea of itself is this kind of like salad bowl, like haven of multiculturalism. They're both completely deluded, but at least America's myth of itself allows for a bit more diversity in popular culture. You know, accept it's a nation of immigrants. We're a nation of immigrants as well, but we won't accept that. You know, this is an island nation that's just been constantly and consistently invaded and settled and inhabited by waves of different people from around the world. And if it hadn't been, then it wouldn't be the country that it is today.
Riz is right. Britain loves a period drama, and historical fiction is hugely powerful in a country's understanding of itself. So I put this to film producer Alison Owen. For context, I use the musical Hamilton as an example of casting that tells a different story.
It had black actors and actresses playing slave owners.
Yeah, so, and that's what was so fantastic, flipping the whole thing on its head. I don't know that the world is ready. I think you could do that in a movie because it's stylized. I think what's hard, what I sometimes struggle with in terms of people telling me you've got to do colorblind casting, I find that hard when you're realizing actual historical moments. Like if I was remaking Elizabeth I, would you be able to cast Elizabeth I as a black woman and just like carry on as normal in the film?
What's colorblind casting?
Like not like literally not just thinking, okay, who's the best person for the role? And it doesn't matter what racial derivation. And I suppose to some extent, you should be able to do the same with gender if you were taking the argument to its logical conclusion. But I think the truth is also really important to me. And I think if you're rendering a historical moment, surely you want to render that as truthfully as possible.
Case in point, her 2015 film Suffragette, about Britain's women's suffrage movement in the early 20th century.
I spent 10 years making a movie that I really believed in and fought to make this movie, which was probably the first movie made about that subject that was with a decent budget and with proper cast. And it did fantastically well in Britain, and it got widely reviled in America because, from my point of view, from an inaccurate perception that there should have been black women in it. Now, no matter how many times I said endless Q&As across America, but there were no black women in the East End at that time, we've endlessly researched it, nobody would listen, and everyone got very angry. I couldn't understand it. And Amma Asante, who's a friend of mine, was the only person who sufficiently explained it to me. She said, Alison, I was like, why are they picking on me? This is a good movie. You know, I'm a lovely white liberal here. What's your fucking problem? You know, why don't you go pick on some other violent movie again? You know, there's lots of horrible movies out there. There's no black people in Downton Abbey. There's no black people in Theory of Everything or lots of horrible action movies. Why are you picking on this nice suffragette movie? And she said, look, what really makes black women in America angry is that all those things you've just said do make them angry. But what makes them most angry is not being a part of something that they perceive they should have been a part of. And that's why your film's making them angry. And I totally got that when she said that. I was like, you know what? I do get that. And I always have to remember that it's not about me, you know. Okay, I'm upset and disappointed about that reception to Suffragette, but that is a drop in the ocean compared to everything that these people who are feeling that have gone through. So me to labour on about my disappointment and resentment about that is I should just shut the fuck up, basically.
There was some conversation at the time about Sophia Dulip Singh, I believe a South Asian suffragette, who I know of because the woman who wrote the book about her is with my publishing company.
Really?
What did you make of that conversation?
Well, we knew about Sophia Dulip Singh, and she was like Queen Victoria's granddaughter, but she was very aristocratic, and our film was about working class women. We very much, there have been movies and TV things about the Pankhursts and the sort of upper class suffragette movement, but we were very wanted to get away from that kind of crinoline suffragette and really portray them as the guerrillas of their day, throwing bombs and getting beaten up by the police. And we wanted to concentrate on the working class suffragettes, so we didn't want to have Queen Victoria's granddaughter. And she was the only women of colour in the suffragette movement were very aristocratic ones, and that wasn't what we were portraying. Now, you could make a, I think in hindsight, and in looking at the importance of See It to Be It and recognising how important it is for women of colour to see themselves on screen, I would rethink that, and I would try and weave in some of those women to be more representative.
Mira wonders if, because of white-focused stories, things are actually getting worse for British actors of colour.
Riz Ahmed, Archie Punjabi, Perminder Nagra, who was in Bend It Like Beckham, had to go to the States and do ER. Obviously, Idris. Marianne Jean-Baptiste was the first British black woman to get an Oscar nomination, and she couldn't get work here. And she went to the States, and there she is now. It's shameful. Why? I think sometimes there's a feeling like we've done diversity. You know, we've done that. There's lots of different strands to this question, actually. We're now post-diversity. We just cast the right person for the job. That's an excuse often used. I suppose the other thing is the kind of stories that we are put in, I think, causes a lot of actors to go to America, because if the only stories you're offered here as an actor are to play a sex abuser or a terrorist or a victim of a violent father in an arranged marriage, then you're probably going to look elsewhere for your roles. I don't want to sound too negative, because I think there are changes, and I can switch on, and the soaps are the best at this, actually, ironically. I can switch on some programmes and see the Britain I know. But then you look at the quality of the role and the kind of narrative that those characters have been given. And that's a whole other question.
Take two examples. There's no new devil's advocate. There's no new tough black voice in that sense. There's no new Desmonds. They don't know how to do it. They don't know how to do it.
Farouk Dondi, a British Black Panther in the 1970s, a television commissioner by the 1990s, and a sharp critic of British television dabbling in race. There was, however, one recent British TV programme he did have significant input on. Gorilla.
Oh dear.
Airing in 2017, Sky Atlantic's much-debated television series Gorilla profiled the love of two young activists of colour fighting racism in 1970s London. Being a former Black Panther meant that Farouk acted as a consultant for the creators of the show.
And they gave me the scripts before that. And I said, hang on. I told them, this has nothing to do with what we actually did, because we never resorted to making a bomb or terrorism or anything. And they said, oh, you did that? I said, yeah, but that wasn't the mainstream. That was breakaway people doing that kind of thing. So there was a kind of threat of violence and so on. Frida Pinto, they based it on my late ex-wife, Marla. And I said, she wasn't a terrorist. And he said, really? We've talked to so-and-so, so-and-so, and so, and she was quite for violence, right? She was saying, shoot a policeman, do something, right? And Marla might have talked like that.
But she didn't actually
do it. She didn't.
So you felt it was a misrepresentation then of what happened?
In a sense, yes, because we were a political movement, right? We were a political movement, Black Panther movement. So was Yesterday. You know, nobody resorted to secret bombings and that. We wanted the public to join us.
What do you think about the criticisms that came of the show about its
erasure? Oh, that the Asian girl shouldn't be there. Well, I think that's all rubbish.
The erasure of black women in particular, because I think Elizabeth Obi wrote in The Guardian saying, now I was there, and
of course,
the only black woman who was in it was a sex worker in the first program, and she wasn't very happy about that.
Liz is being stupid, because Liz was the best friend of Marla, my ex-wife. They were like that, inseparable. I mean, still. Mala left Liz a lot of her, when she died 4 years ago, she left her a lot of stuff. Liz and Mala were like that. Liz might have thought that maybe Althea should have been represented, but they were black girls. There were black women in the show. But I don't agree with the fact that there should not have been an Asian activist.
This is what Elizabeth Obi wrote in The Guardian. For those of us who were around at the time, the role of Jazz Mitra, played by Frida Pinto, is quite obviously in recognition of Marla Sen, who was part of the leadership of the Black Panther movement and a member of the Race Today collective, alongside the late Darcus Howe and Farouk Dondi, who acted as consultants for the series. For me, it was an absolute pleasure to have Marla's contribution acknowledged through the role of Jazz, and I'm interested to see how her character unfolds, if nothing else. Aside from Jazz, the portrayal of black women in the first episode was unforgivable, as they are represented solely by Wumi Mosaku's character Kenya, a sex worker whose clients include the police officer Pence. Historically, women were the backbone of the black movement. Althea Jones-Lequant, Barbara Bees, Leila Hassan, Olive Morris, Beverly Bryan and Stella Dadsey, to name but a few, and I can only hope this is reflected in future episodes.
Yes. I don't think Guerrillas is a continuation of the work that we did.
Mm.
I don't think so. I think it's a transatlantic entertainment Netflix type of program.
Well, that's really interesting.
It's more Game of Thrones than Desmond's.
Culture is never not important in how we perceive the world. And I think that's why conversations about accurate media representation in our cultural products, books and films and television, music, theatre and media, will continue to rage until access to those professions is less exclusive. But there's also a convincing argument to be made that suggests that this is all somewhat of a distraction, drawing us away from the harder ways politics affects our lives. Diane Abbott MP is sceptical of putting too much hope in culture.
Politics is not a consumer activity. I wouldn't say that everyone has to get involved in the Labour Party. I've never said that in 30-odd years of political activity. You've got to get involved in something. There's a tendency for people to think that politics is something you consume, and there's a tendency, which actually goes back, to think that a man on a white horse is going to come over the horizon and save us. No one's going to save black people. We have to save ourselves. And whereas I wouldn't say everyone has to join the Labour Party, you've got to join something. Because if you're just going to events at the Tate and going home and feeling reinforced in your ideas about society, who does that help? How does that change anything? When I came into politics at the end of the 70s, early 80s, clearly cultural politics was a backdrop. Clearly. I mean, I'd consumed all of the main feminist texts, Female Unit, Kate Millett. I consumed Spare Rib, because, you know, in the days before the internet, if you wanted to find out about what's happening politically, you had to go to a bookshop and buy something. So I consumed all of the cultural products in relation to feminism, and I consumed all of the 80s black female writers, Alice Walker, Maya Angelou, Toni Cade, Barbara, I think she was. I read all of that, and it undoubtedly presented the backdrop to my activism and literature and activity and writing and discussion is a necessary backdrop now. But the idea that all you have to do is listen to a podcast and a town hall near you is going to promote
loud and clear on this one.
It's going to promote some poor black woman who's worked there for 20 years to the role she should be in. There's not necessarily a connection. Because what the local state and what institutions rely on is that we don't get involved. They rely on the fact that we don't get involved. And they rely on the fact that they can talk the talk, but no one's coming to them and saying, excuse me, how many senior social workers do you have who are actually black women, even though a lot of your junior ones are? So to an extent, the people that come to your events are concerned about, they are relying on the fact that people don't get involved.
I put these concerns to the actor and activist Riz Ahmed.
Are we guilty of selling the people who like our work a vision of feeling empowered and feeling represented that isn't actually translating into some sort of political change?
I mean, I think it depends whether the reality that you're kind of selling people is an escapist reality or is something that engages with our reality in order to kind of challenge and stretch it. I think often you can have both. I mean, look at something like Black Panther. There is a lot of escapism in Black Panther. It's a, you know, fantastical country doesn't really exist. The whole reality is kind of like, it's a superhero movie. And yeah, actually, I think that because it's not a film that's kind of steeped in social realism, it can actually comment on our society and really engage with it in a way that feels quite free, actually. It's free to do that. And I think science fiction, for example, or fantasy has always had an ability to do that. So again, I actually don't think the two things are always mutually exclusive. I think the danger isn't so much that we offer people perspectives on the world that are at odds with dominant culture, and that in doing so, we're deluding them or selling them a mirage as to how things are. I think our political and social reality as shaped by dominant culture is all too obvious to those of us who kind of live with its boot on our neck. I don't think there's any danger that we'll kind of like forget what our reality is like, you know.
It's great that people can read a book and feel like, yes, this is speaking for me, but like it can't end there.
No, but I think we're not maybe not giving people enough credit if we think it does end there. I don't think it does end there. I think they carry that extra bit of confidence that, okay, let's say I'm not used to seeing myself in literature. Let's say I read a book where someone like me is at the center of the story. If I just put that book down and carry on going to work, I'm still going to carry that feeling of being, you know, a hero in my own story with me to work that week. I will just have my experience reaffirmed. That may give me a different kind of confidence. It may allow me to kind of question some of my self-hate or how I think of myself as a bit player in my own life. I think the effect of art and culture is sometimes quite intangible, but on a kind of emotional, molecular level, I think people carry its impact with them throughout their day, throughout their month, throughout their years. In terms of like showing up as an activist, becoming politically engaged in our society, it is really, really important if you care about changing our society. Does that mean that any art that doesn't make you stand up and sign up for Momentum is a waste of time? No, of course not. It doesn't. It affects people in different ways.
One thing that strikes me as a conflict is that as our culture has become more woke, formal politics has become increasingly regressive.
We live in a Britain today that is in large part shaped by Nigel Farage, but we also live in the London of Sadiq Khan. And those things can coexist. So do we have some progress in pop culture and in politics? Yes. Do we have some real challenges in both of those still? Yes, absolutely. In a way, I think those two things can be true at the same time. In terms of like more directly to your question, is a more inclusive popular culture bringing out a more inclusive political reality? I think time will tell. I think sometimes these things can take a while to filter down. But, you know, you hear things like, okay, would you have ever had Obama without Jay-Z, for example, which might sound like a kind of facile question to ask. But I do think that, you know, when a generation of young people grows up seeing certain faces and certain people as a normalized presence in their reality and normalized as role models as well, I think that that does kind of filter through to how they see the world, how they engage with people in the world, and also how they vote. Does it solve all our problems? No. Will you still have resistance to that? Yes. Do we have a really kind of segmented pop cultural landscape where actually you could totally grow up in the 90s and early 2000s and never have listened to Jay-Z? Yeah, absolutely. I grew up, I've never listened to the Beatles. I still don't know really any of their music. So I think you can have these contradictory things existing at the same time.
I started this episode wondering if there was a bit of disconnect between woke pop culture and harder political decisions. But now I'm convinced it's not a strict either-or situation. The two influence each other, for better or for worse. Fictionalized versions of current affairs can make or break public empathy towards a situation. I don't think my non-fiction book would have had the impact it did in Britain without the Brexit vote a year before its release. And in a more extreme example, there would be no current president of the United States without a television show. I can only sincerely hope that Britain doesn't follow in the same footsteps. When it comes to the people who are commissioning our culture, well, the fact that so few wanted to speak to me tells me that they're not yet ready to be held accountable for what they create. In the meantime, DIYing it may be the most surefire way to secure the culture that you want to see. This week, I want to signal boost Scene on Radio's Seeing White series. It's a really fascinating deep delve into the construction and invention of whiteness in the political sense in the US. The ways that it's been written into their laws, who is white and who isn't, has been battled out in the Supreme Court. It's absolutely fascinating. And I think that, you know, when it comes to discussing race, we are so quick to talk about people who have defied the odds, but we never really talk about the odds in the first place and the barriers that they've had to overcome. And I think that if you want to really think about whiteness as a political construction and a power structure, this is a podcast to start. It's really fascinating. So it's a big thumbs up from me. About Race with Rennie Edo Lodge is written by me. It's produced by Renee Richardson. Our researcher is Res Marino, and our research assistant is Isis Thompson. Original music is by Matt Sibiso, and artwork is by Kevin Morosky. You can join in the conversation using the hashtag AboutRaceWithRennie. Full transcripts and episodes are available on our website, aboutracepodcast.com. This podcast is funded by Arts Council England.